Welcome to the Working Tools Podcast, where today we will continue our discussion of observing the craft with Chapter 1, Why Does Observing the Craft Matter? In the book by Andrew Hammer.
Ladies and gentlemen, brethren all, welcome to the Working Tools Podcast, a casual conversation around Freemasonry. First, it's important to note that our thoughts and opinions are our own and do not reflect those of our Grand Lodge or respective craft or concordant bodies. Please connect with us and ask questions via our website at theworkingtoolspodcast.com.
Today on the Working Tools Podcast, we have our usual group of hosts, as usual. We have very worshipful brother David Colbeth, who's a member of King Solomon number 60 in Auburn, Washington. I'm Matt Apple, and I'm a member of Mill Creek 243 in Montlake Terrace, Washington. And we have worshipful brother Jared Dunham from Penticton 147 in Penticton, British Columbia. And worshipful brother Stephen Chung in Prince Charles number 153 in lovely Kelowna, British Columbia. As opposed to Penticton, you know. So, in our last episode, we discussed the preface of Observing the Craft by Andrew Hammer, which, again, I encourage everyone to go out and grab a copy of and read along with us. The first chapter, it's pretty short. But how did Jared say it earlier? It's a shorty but a goody. So, well, I guess my question is, why do you think it's so good there, Jared? What's the meat of this chapter here?
The meat of this chapter? I don't know, but there is something underlined that I liked. Further in. I mean, he talks about the Enlightenment and the ideals of the Enlightenment, which we, you know, all talk about and stuff like that. But it's interesting that he writes that the men who established our rituals and codified the structure of the craft would be appalled at the notion that nothing was ever to be questioned, studied, or understood, but merely followed in a manner more befitting sheep than seekers of light. And I like that line, because recently I've actually been spending a lot of time, like, people are, well, you got to do it this way. And I'm like, why? Didn't say that in the ritual. You know, and I think that's part of the meat of this, is that it's one thing to learn your ritual. It's another thing to understand why it is the way it is and what it means. And that's because, you know, he talks about I'm going to flip back to the preface, because there was actually something in there stuck out for me. There was about the craft. Oh, maybe it was in this one. Sorry. About working, is that the allegory to labor that runs through the fabric of our institution is no mere literary device. The work of Freemasonry sets before us certain tasks which require genuine effort, as does any sincere attempt at self-improvement. Sort of near the end of this chapter. And I'm hoping that we don't get in trouble for me doing all this reading on, because, you know, fair use. But, you know, it's the notion that it's work. It's hard work, you know, and it shouldn't be easy. It shouldn't be. You shouldn't feel at the end of receiving your master Mason degree and, you know, maybe doing your prove up that you got it.
Well, as you alluded in the previous show, that craftsmanship, craftsmanship.
I always bring this up too, is that we talk about this is a lifelong pursuit, and yet we want it now, and we want to rush everyone through the degrees now, because, you know, we need bodies now. And I'm like, but we're not creating quality. So, and I think for me, that this chapter, that's why it's about that. For me, this is why observing the craft matters, is the quality of your experience in Lodge. And we can't expect to get that quality if we're going to slack off on the work that we're doing.
So did you, when you joined, and all of you, did you already know that Masonry was either the avenue or the opportunity, or would provide you the avenue, an opportunity to get more enlightenment? I mean, Steve kind of mentioned on the last show that it was an extension of his Demon Lake development. And so it wasn't necessarily that he was seeking something specific. I mean, to paraphrase for you, Steve, but it was more of an extension of his DMLA career. And so, I mean, when I joined, I can't say honestly that I knew really that there was going to be this deep philosophical underbelly.
Man, as I've said before, I'm a legacy. I joined because my dad was a Mason. His dad was a Mason. His dad before him was a Mason. I knew nothing other than this is what my dad did on Thursday nights, and I thought it was cool. And it wasn't it wasn't until I came back hardcore about 10 years ago when I actually picked up this book that I started really doing the work that should be required. You know, so yeah,
you know, to bring it back to my comments, I had I'd always understood that they say that we took good men and made them better, but I never really understood how we did that. I understood that there were lessons that were veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols, and it was up to me to find them. And, you know, I've learned what I refer to as life lessons through Masonry, often through learning some of the memory work and performing it over and over again to where I finally gained an understanding of it, right? But you know what, you know what he says in here about, you know, observing the craft and why it's like it makes me think that if I was, or I'll preface that a little bit. Because I do the 6-step program, I'm the first guy that meets all of our seekers. And I'm always asking them, and there's lots of guys that come in and say, the fellowship, the camaraderie, the brotherhood, right? But almost every single one of them says, to improve myself. And I understand that this is what Freemasonry does. And now this gives me a whole different outlook or opinion or comments, things I can comment on, that this is how we do that. You know, we make good men better by, as he says in here, observing the craft matters, because if we, by doing so, we obligate ourselves to a new, to actually do what we said we came here to do, right? And it's like, yeah, and now I can have a better way to explain to seekers on how that actually happens, which I think is really cool, because even, you know, they don't have to become the best ritualists as per se, but they have to strive to be better in these things. They hold themselves to higher standards, and by striving to be the best that they can be at these things, they are thereby improving themselves already, right? So it is rather interesting when you think about it the way he's proposed it.
So as I've said in this pod before, I joined Masonry essentially in a quest to have the companionship of other adult men when I was the stay-at-home dad of an infant. And I probably honestly said something on my petition along the lines of, you know, community service, rah-rah kind of thing, because I sort of thought that's what one ought to say. But, I mean, so that makes out of the four of us here, one who sort of, I'll point in the direction that Steve is on my screen, one who sort of came at it for the moral lessons and the self-improvement aspect of Masonry, which again brings me back to my pyramid theory of lots of guys coming in the bottom, but only a few achieving the high pinnacle of being a podcast host that we, as we all have. But the I do wonder if, so I haven't read this book in a long time, and I've only read the parts that we were discussing to this point. I do wonder if we restricted our membership of the applicants, the petitioners, to only people who were seeking enlightenment. I mean, none of the three out of the four of us would not be here, right?
Yeah. And I think too, when I first joined, if I knew ahead of time some of the things that were maybe expected of me, I may not have taken that journey because I may have been scared about it or wasn't interested in it at the time. But kind of as Jared said, now coming back, I've been a Mason 15 years now, and now I'm very interested in it. I mean, I wrote in here that when I joined and went through the degrees, I was a little bit childlike and that I didn't read ahead and I didn't have any an understanding of what Masonry is about. Didn't know about any of the rituals, didn't know about any of the illusions and this whole idea. And so I went through the degree process and became a Master Mason with the childlike understanding and assuming that what was presented to me and what I went through was somewhat literal, and didn't realize, and I wrote, wasn't really told either. And maybe I was told, but I didn't hear it, that it was illusionary. And they did say the whole, you know, veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols and all that stuff. But that didn't connect with me. It was just a byline, like, you know, be one, ask one, or make good men better. It was just those marketing lines to me. They weren't, I didn't realize those were the truths. Yes, there's way more to this than what you were presented with. And that wasn't presented in my lodge initially. At least, again, maybe I wasn't ready for it either. That could have been too. Maybe they were presenting it to me and kept hitting me over the head, David, and I just wasn't listening.
Maybe it just wasn't presented to you well.
Maybe.
Because I have it. It's there. It's in the ritual. Like,
sure,
okay,
sure.
It's in our ritual. I always have to say that because there is no one ritual. But I sometimes think that when, and we will come across this in further chapters, when ritual is not performed to a certain degree, or sorry, level, I shouldn't use the word degree. When it's not performed to a certain standard, the message is lost. I mean, when I went through the first three degrees, the internet was in its infancy and I couldn't read ahead. There wasn't the concept of learning about ritual or anything because you couldn't. So I went in knowing that my father would never put me in a situation that would do me harm. So it's so long ago. I'm trying to remember how I felt.
Just cause, yeah, you know. I think too, there was an element of trust and I had gotten to know the guys well enough that I didn't feel concerned until they got to some of the parts of the of the obligation. I thought, whoa. But they had said, you know, basically, right, trust us, basically. And so I did. And I'm glad we did and got through it all. But again, I didn't realize that there was this heavy meeting under it. And even though, yeah, so you hear the lectures over and over again, you hear the ritual over and over again, you know, it's not as well taught as it could have been, I think. And hopefully we're doing a better job of that now. But one of the things I comment on was that he talks about the creators of the ritual, as you mentioned about the preface, that they didn't expect us to criticize or to question the ritual. And yeah, I think now I have that understanding that, yes, I think they wanted us to discuss it to some extent. But he also mentioned those that codified. And I think there's some that have written the code and constitution that don't want you to question the code and constitution, but I think that should absolutely be questioned at all times, the code and constitutions, because they're...
Well, but that's different. I think that's... Because that's... I think we need to make sure that we make a distinction between ritual, which was written, and your code, our regulations and constitutions, which are the rules and guidelines in which we, because there's a difference between how you run the lodge and the ritual itself.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, and it's what the importance here is that we're supposed to take the ritual and the lessons that are learned in the ritual and try to understand why is it we do it this, like, what, okay, so why do we do a certain thing a certain way? Is it in the ritual? Is that actually, why have they told us to do that? I think that's what he's talking about, in so we have a better understanding of our ritual. Because when you do something blindly, just because, well, it's always been done this way, there's no deeper, you don't get any deeper meaning than just the face value. And that's not what Freemasonry is about. But Matthew had a look on his face.
Well, this isn't what that look was about, but one of the things, there is some deep stuff in Masonry, and I'm not denying that at all. If you really want to drill down on some of these things, know that whatever the beehive is an emblem of industry. That's all basically it says in the ritual, right? I mean, there's a paragraph or whatever, but it's basically go forth, do work. And you could look at the beehive as a on other levels than just that. And it's frankly, it's one of what I think of this one of the cooler symbols of Masonry. But the point is that even if you just took the surface, so there's the surface level, it's a beehive, it's a home for bees. And then there's like the second level, which is it's an emblem of industry. And even if you don't go to the third, fourth, fifth levels beyond that, you know what? Even if you just do what the ritual says, that's pretty good. You don't really have to, I mean, I'm not saying no one should ever look beyond that, and I think people should, but even if you never do, if you just follow the compasses are to keep you within due bounds and the square is to teach you to act with how you act with your brother men and especially another Mason, you know what? That'd make you a pretty darn good person right there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there is some literal value in the words. But also we are reading, at least in Washington, how many versions later than what we might consider the ancient work? And that's something I've started to read it in the past, and it's so hard to read. So this work that we assume was done mostly by Preston, this is what we have now. And so he enhanced it. It's kind of like getting a translation. What did it really mean? And as I've been understanding, learning some other things, you have to understand how it was translated and what the original context of the original meaning was to really know. You have to be almost a master of that original language to know what they really meant when they first wrote it. And then when it was translated or enhanced in our case, what was it enhanced to? And is that have the same meaning that it used to?
And there's like recently I've been going through our ritual and I'm like, I think there's pieces missing. Like there's certain things that we do in our ritual and I'm like, but you sort of get to a point where you're like, I think there's a part missing out of this book, and it always kind of bothers me that, when they wrote down the book, the ritual book that we have, or whenever someone wrote down, even because I know that with my Headley Lodge, we had a ritual that predates our current Grand Lodge ritual book. And, at some point someone sat down with an old member and they kind of wrote down how our ritual is supposed to go. And I still think that there's something missing, and has that happened? Is there a piece out of our ritual that's because someone forgot it? We do things a certain way, but maybe we should be adding a part.
And that alludes as well to the way you mentioned that every lodge could kind of do its own thing, right? There's many versions of ritual out there. And which one is the real ritual?
Ours.
Emulation.
I was going to say, in Washington State, I can tell you there was one ritual.
But you have like, what, five up there?
Four.
Just four?
Four approved rituals, according to our Constitution.
Well, approved, but aren't there a couple of there's a couple that are practiced that aren't of. They get
They're still technically. It's just there are minor different, some minor, well, major, for some people's. There are different differences in the way some of the stuff is done, but technically, it's still the same ritual.
So it might be slightly using different words, but yeah, it's done very similar.
Different people do different parts and do it in a different way, but it's still technically.
Yeah. Okay. Just different enough to make you go, huh?
Yeah. Well, that's not the face I make usually, but okay.
Hmm.
So the other thing he talks about in here is, well, it's an elaboration of the idea that there's lodges on one end of the spectrum and lodges on the other end of the spectrum, and that every lodge has the opportunity to be whatever lodge they want. So he refers to good time lodges, right? And they're, you know, all they are focusing on is having a good time and having supper and getting together and socializing, more or less. And then on the other extreme, there's what he believes is the observant lodge, and that all lodges should be marching towards this observance necessarily. And there have been some presentations that I've attended that talk about the certain values that a lodge maybe should have, probably community service and education and all these different pillars. And there's a balance there. There's which kind of lodge do you want to go to? Is it more focused on education, or is it more focused on community service, or is it more focused on social? And you have to decide which lodge you want to go to based on those. And he alludes that you should direct a man to those lodges, and a lodge should determine what its focus should be. And I have a hard time with that, because ultimately, if he's saying we should all be observant lodges, and that there's these good time lodges on the far end, I put a little diagram. I have the two lodges, and then I have a line like a teeter totter, and I have a fulcrum in the middle. And I think a lodge really should be balanced. You should have, and I think King Solomon, our lodge in Auburn, has become much more balanced. I'm going to start coining the term fulcrum lodge, and that we are observant when, I'm sorry, this hand, we're observant when we need to be, and are focused on development, but we also have a good time. We enjoy each other's company. We enjoy the social aspects and all that. Go, Jared. He's chopping.
Well, just because you're observant doesn't mean that you're not having a good time. Like the point that you're making is you're actually getting closer to observant, and you're enjoying yourself because it's observant.
because they're
not diametrically opposed. And once again, I don't want to jump ahead in the book, but you know, that's the point, is that it's the problem that you get is the issue I have with that, the statement of let all lodges be whatever they want to be, is that when you get into an area like mine, where we're a very small area, and if I want to join an observant lodge, I can't. There isn't a lodge in our area that I would actually classify in this way. And that's exactly, I think,
one of the things I wondered, would you essentially kill all rural lodges in an effort to only have observant ones?
But why? So here's the question. And this maybe end up having to go to another show here, but why do we consider rural or small town lodges to be not observant? It's just because that's the way things have become or been allowed. I mean, he does allude to that. Ideas don't die. They lose focus and lack.
I'm not saying that by definition, we're not that rural. I mean, my God. But I'm not saying.
Is that a moose behind you? Is that...
No, it's deer. God, the deer in this town. I'm not. The problem isn't. How to put this? It's not so much that rural lodges aren't observant. It's that when you have a small when you have a small population to pull from, if you want a quality lodge, and by definition of an observant lodge, I don't think there are, like, you either have to focus on it or you're not going. In this case, it is diametrically opposed, in that you either focus on it or you won't get it. But I don't think aiming for an observant lodge will kill rural lodges. It may diminish the number of them, but in larger areas like down on the lower mainland, there are enough lodges to search from that I could probably find one to go to if I truly wanted an observant lodge, because it's where the majority of the people live.
Well, but,
you know, allowing a lodge to just become a good time, like the good time lodge, that just sounds so, you know, oh, it's a good time lodge. You know, is that they've lost their focus on Freemasonry. That going and just having, I can go and have a good time with my friends. That's not what I go to lodge for.
At a good time lodge, does the master wear a lampshade instead of a top hat?
Because that's what I'm thinking when you say good time lodge. You know, the master's got a lampshade.
Red, the straw hat with a red band, you know.
Or they're all wearing the paper Christmas hats, you know. But doing a conga line into lodge because, you know.
You know, I guess it depends on how you're looking at it, right? Like, to some extent, I think that we at Prince Charles, a lot of us are trying to be observant, if you go by the definitions of what he's saying in the book. We are trying to, you know, we hold our dress code. We believe we should show up in crisp, clean tux. We should do our work well. And I think that in our lodge, we have a lot of guys that strive for that better, higher standard. And so in some senses, we are an observant lodge. Just not everybody's dived in and embraced that. There are some guys who aren't as observant, if you will. They've let their they've stopped coming in a tuxedo. They'll wear a suit jacket and their slacks, and you know, that's okay. Generally, it was generally okay when a guy had to come straight from work and didn't have time to go home and get on his tux. We would, you know, it's acceptable dress, but to be holding yourself to that higher standard, that's one of the things that's been allowed to be more lax, if you will, is the attire, right? So yeah, I think in some senses we are a bit of an observant lodge, because we don't have all the social aspect. We don't have all the other things, right? So I don't know, my observation.
Yeah, I still think that the reason it would kill the rural lodges is because they're not really Masonic lodges anymore. I think that they're just social clubs.
Then let them die.
Sure, right? And as another pitch, that's why I was hoping my resolution would make it to the floor of random communication, but apparently it didn't. So, but not that doesn't. Bitter. Yeah, I'm not bitter at all. But it honestly, wouldn't it? In my mind, it would lend more to a smaller area, because then you could almost, I hate to say cherry pick, but you could almost bring in guys that are looking for something like that. And if you looked at who I was, and kind of as you admitted, Jared, 10, 20 years ago, we weren't the same seekers that we are today in Masonry. And so should we say the same thing about our current members that aren't seeking? Is it just because, do we think that they can't be seekers of knowledge and seekers of light and be more observant, or is it because they haven't had the opportunity, or maybe they haven't had the focus either? I think King Solomon, an example, again, not to toot her home, but I'm going to, that I think those, because as we come, if we'll coin it, more observant, as we become more parent and attentive on the things that should be brought to focus, I think, as they say, the rising tide floats all boats. And so I think some of the guys are coming in saying, oh, this is important. Like you mentioned, there's things that we do that they have no meaning. It's a very small example. And we're getting close to the end here, but very small example. We were having a practice for a degree, and I said, hey, one of our fellow, not elder, but senior Masons, he's been a Mason a long time, and we were closing the Bible up, and he put the square and compasses on top of the Bible. And I said, hey, can I ask everybody here why do we do it this way? Why do you put the square and compasses in this fashion? And nobody had an answer. I said, this is a good majority of the guys here in the lodge. Why don't we right now make a decision on how we're going to do it as a lodge and why we're going to do it? And so there was some debate back and forth, isn't that? And we have now established a process and a pseudo history of why we place the square and compasses on the Bible in a certain fashion and for certain. And so a guy can walk in the room and look at the square and compasses, and he knows what degree we're going to open on because of the placement of the closed Bible, the square and compasses on the closed Bible.
Then you haven't disarranged your symbols enough.
Oh yes. They're completely disarranged. They're not connected in any fashion.
You've just created your own little symbolism of how you've, if you, when if you, you when will. You put them on them as to what degree you're going to open on.
If you Interesting. Will. If you will. Just so that now there's this. So now when you teach the senior deacon, this is how we do it. This is how King Solomon does it. And if somebody says why, we have a little history. We have a little reason behind it. And so I think just it's something little tiny, but it does develop that, so why do we do certain things? It's not codified. It's not the ritual. You just close the great lights. Well, what do you do with this stuff when it's closed? How do you close the great lights? Doesn't say how to do it. I mean, we could go on and on, but anyway, it just was something kind of fun. So I agree. We should question why we do things. And then as a lodge, if you want that culture, develop those reasons why.
So on the note of innovations in masonry.
It's not an innovation.
It looks like we're reaching the end of our time here for this episode. So again, I encourage you to check out Andrew Hammer's book. It's pretty cool. We will be continuing to discuss it for the next few episodes. On behalf of Stephen and Jared and David and myself, we thank you all for listening to the Working Tools podcast, and we look forward to talking to you again soon. Goodbye.